Hello, hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friends Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I apologize that we are a little bit late. I know that some people have been sitting here waiting for a little bit, and that is because Herman was in a meeting, unfortunately. But he is now with us, and we are very happy to have him here. So, of course, we are joined today by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
Here.
And, of course, everyone's favorite son of Benoni, Mr. Marius Ruit. Marius, how are you?
How's it, guys?
Very good. So, of course, looting and stuff is still, I think, going on in some parts of the country. From what I can tell, it's not quite as the tempo has subsided a bit. But obviously, I think there's still many trouble spots around the country, particularly in KZN. So we're going to not talk too much about it, I think, because, of course, we've talked about it for the last 3 days, but we will touch on it here and there. I just want to say that it's absolutely fantastic to see all the people going out there right now who are doing their bit to clean up damage, to prevent looting taking place. There's just people all over, pictures and videos of that stuff coming through. It's really heartening to see the moderate middle of South Africa standing up and saying no to the breakers and the takers.
Nick, can I quickly add something on that?
Yeah, sure.
And I almost want to use that just to show one of these five precious digits to the race hustlers in this country who made this a race thing in the last few days, or who tried to make this a race thing in the last few days. If you look at the footage of people cleaning up, you see the real South Africa, and it's not one where the hate is, you know, whites hate blacks and blacks hate whites. You can really see when these communities come together, they couldn't give two hoots who they are helping to clean up their community with.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so sort of related to the riots, but I think having implications as well beyond that is the other day, I think it was yesterday or the day before, Julius Malema's Twitter account was suspended by Twitter after they found that he had violated its rules. So Malema had at first been a little bit cautious about quite how he was talking about these things, but of course that didn't last. And when the announcement of the deployment of the South African National Defence Force was made by President Ramaphosa, Julius tweeted, "No soldiers on our streets, otherwise we are joining. All fighters must be ready. They won't kill us all. We need a political solution to a political problem, not soldiers. Hashtag no to soldiers." He then pinned that to the top of his Twitter account. And shortly thereafter, he was suspended from Twitter for 11 hours. So, of course, he's back now. But this caused the EFF to become very upset. His minion, Lozi, said, "Dear Twitter, don't silence voices that are calling for political solution to political problems as opposed to violence and massacres. Your suspension of this account gives advantage to bloodthirsty racist killers in South Africa with no regard for black lives."
Is he describing the EFF there? I think
something like that. But yeah, we also saw a character who I actually haven't heard that much from recently, but is no stranger to controversy, Irvin Jim, come out and support Julius Malema, saying that a suspension of Malema's Twitter account is completely undemocratic. The fundamental question, what process did Twitter follow before they suspended? Did they hear his side of story?
Marius, I think it's so cold that Nick's internet connection is freezing.
Yeah, it seems like it's... Nick, are you with us? And it'll obviously happen when we're doing a live podcast.
I mean, this is an undemocratic, you know, just a suspension of Nick Lorimer, because what process was followed here? But I think let's take it further. I must say, Marius, what did you think about the suspension? Especially if we look at the reality that just a year ago we saw something similar happen to Donald Trump, and this is a frontier of you know, free speech being impeded that really seems to fall not with principles but along political lines.
Yeah, it's, I feel quite conflicted on this because I'm not the greatest fan of Julius Malema, but just like anybody else, he has a right to free speech. And it becomes so tricky. I mean, was what we were saying incitement to violence, which is one of the only times that you can actually restrict free speech, in my opinion. I'm not sure that it was. And obviously, there's no legal threshold on Twitter. Twitter can kick anybody off that once. But Twitter is now so big. It's the same argument with Facebook. It is now so big, it is basically the town square, and nobody should be silenced in the town square unless they are in, calling for violence or whatever the case is. But, I mean, the precedent has been set. I mean, the president of the United States himself was kicked off Twitter, which I still, I mean, I'm also not a fan of Donald Trump, but I also think that was a ridiculous decision. And but I think as I mean this kind of thing is not going to end anytime soon. How's it, Nick? You back? And I mean this is going to be a new frontier for people who are interested in things like free speech and free expression. As I mean, Twitter and Facebook might not be here in 10 years' time. These kinds of technologies have a way of disappearing, and you're not you know, they kind of collapse quickly. I mean, MySpace I think is a good example, but the way this this kind of thing happens, Twitter and Facebook or whatever succeeds them, I was going to have to grapple with these kinds of questions.
But just in defense of MySpace, I think what happened there was just, I mean, Australia is famous for its poisonous reptiles. And Rupert Murdoch, speaking of poisonous Australian reptiles, bought MySpace. So I think if you're looking for a culprit in the death of that specific, you know, initiative, look no further than Rupert Murdoch.
And Nick, please mute
I disconnect for 30 seconds. Bad Australian impressions are going
on. Exactly.
Sorry about that. been doing this show for, 7 months or something on YouTube, and I disconnect the first week that we are recording live. But anyway, okay, so did you guys discuss the impact that these that you think that social media might have had on these on the looting? Okay, so Herman, question to you. I think that there's been some people in the sort of ruling party, some people in the media. It's not been an overwhelming feeling, but there's been some who've sort of said, look, this is being driven in part by social media and provocateurs on social media. So, of course, the Zuma children famously tweeted support for the looters. We see Malema here. And, of course, the DA, I think, has laid charges of incitement against Malema and the Zuma children over some of the things they said. So do you think it's played a particularly big role? We had a discussion about this actually in a meeting a couple of days ago, an internal meeting. What do you think?
Well, I think it's definitely played a role. But I think we must also appreciate the role social media has played in the opposite direction, in making people aware of danger spots, in making people aware of what's going on in their communities, and, of course, giving people the opportunities to stand together to find some sort of solidarity against the chaos that we've seen. We shouldn't underestimate... and I think this is that element. I think this is a very good example of where bad speech or destructive speech is most effectively countered by constructive speech, where if you're going to use social media to spread ideas of chaos and violence and criminality, I'm not saying you've got free rein. I agree with Marius that you've got these grounds that are not protected by freedom of speech, propaganda for war, incitement to violence. I can't remember the third one. There are three in Section 16 of the Constitution. So I'm not saying, you know, laissez-faire free speech for everyone, but I do think this is a very good example of where destructive speech is being met by ordinary people on those very same platforms with constructive speech, making it possible for a country to find a voice and actually even some leadership and gumption and spine for the first time in a long, long while. So, yes, these things can be used for bad purposes. It's like nuclear fission or whatever, or a knife. You can either cut a bread or a person, but it's up to us whether we will be able to use these tools constructively.
But I suppose, I mean, it's the Gutenberg Press. I mean, the Gutenberg Press was also used to print the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Was also used to spread literacy through the world. So, I mean, any of these new technologies can be used for good or ill. And I think your, the nuclear fusion example is a very good one. It can be used in Hiroshima or Nagasaki and can also be used as a form of energy.
Yeah. So I see there's a comment here saying that Ndlozi and Malema received quite a lot of backlash on social media from people saying, look, some of us are EFF people, but we think you're being fooled here in what you're doing. Do you think the EFF is going to take a political beating from its sort of tepid support for the looting and protests?
See, Herman has
agreed to the demands of the public, yes.
He's a man of the people, if nothing else, old Herman Pretorius.
Yes, you know, as they say, vox populi, vox dei.
Exactly. It's hard to say because we also must remember social media is not South Africa. Twitter is a very small microcosm of South Africa. But I do think it does, it tells you what is happening in the broader public. And that's what's with this backlash that people like Ndlozi and Shivambu and Malema have been receiving from their members and people who are obviously pretty loud EFF supporters, people with EFF avatars or, you know, economic freedom in our lifetime and their social media bios and so on. I think it's quite likely that the EFF could go backwards in this upcoming election, but also they have been making inroads in KwaZulu-Natal, and a lot of people who were formerly ANC supporters might be because of, perhaps because of the expulsion of Jacob Zuma, maybe because of the tepid response to the crisis in KwaZulu-Natal by Cyril Ramaphosa and the current government, decide to throw their lot in with the EFF on the ANC. So it's hard to say, but it has been heartening that there has been this pushback from EFF supporters against the most egregious examples of, you know, race baiting from the EFF leadership.
Yeah, I was saying just before the show that the revolutionaries are always able to sell the dream of the revolution to people until people actually see what it looks like, and it looks an awful lot like this, and then suddenly revolutionaries become a lot less popular.
That's what we were saying. Also, what I mentioned, Julius Malema, he's like the king in Shrek. Many of you may lose your lives, but it's a sacrifice I'm willing to make.
Yes. Herman, any final thoughts?
I think one thing that we must be vigilant about as South Africans is what just happened on the other side of the border with Eswatini, where not dissimilar events led to the Eswatini government asking MTN to shut down its network in the country. Mm-hmm. And MTN, with their proud history of appeasing tyrannical regimes, did so. And we must be very vigilant and very, very careful. And it's not often that, you know, I directly challenge people watching and listening to this. But if you're an MTN subscriber or a Vodacom subscriber or a Cell C subscriber, you have a right, and I think even a bit of an obligation, to, especially in this uncertain time, with the Eswatini example just a week ago and with these protests going on, perhaps send a tweet, give a call, send an email, just ask your internet cell phone provider, who are you going to listen to when the calls come for you to shut down this network? What's going to happen? What are you going to do?
I think an important point that needs to be made is that MTN, I think, is owned 49% by the Swaziland government and 10% by the king himself. So I think about 60% of its shareholding is Swazi government. So it's a bit hard for... I definitely agree with what you're saying, but I think the ownership is also a complicated issue.
You know, this was the deal they set themselves up for, and it's in contravention of their own regulations and framework to protect human rights. And I must say, I'm very glad that government did not go to trying something like that, like cutting off the internet to KZN, see happening.
Yeah, that's one thing within South Africa. We have lots of problems, but when all said and done, our democracy, I mean, it's a cliche, but we still have a vibrant democracy. People can say what they want. They can associate with who they want. The government doesn't try to take those kinds of rights away from you. And I think that's still I think we have to,
let's put it this way.
Say what you
let's
want or hang way. Up to who you want, you know?
Let's put it this way. No one's coming in through our doors currently while we record this to put black bags over our heads.
Yes, re-education. But we know that this is a government capable of putting a device in the press gallery in Parliament to stop journalists covering the events in that chamber. We know that they're capable of doing those little steps.
That's for sure, but that's happened once in 27 years. And that was under somebody who's the closest we've come to having a dictator in South Africa. So I think we still have to use, maybe that is the exception that proves the rule in South Africa.
I'm not saying vigilance, not alarm.
What is the price of freedom,
Cameron? Well, I think it's about $4, so that's what, 72,000 rand, these days?
Yeah, somewhere
around, yeah. So, constant vigilance.
Deciding to harp on this for a little bit more, I remember reading a story that I thought really did not get enough traction about the final days of Zuma's presidency. So if you remember, Zuma was recalled by the ANC because he was president at the same time that Ramaphosa was president of the ANC, and there was this obvious sort of disconnect between the two sides, and Zuma refused to heed the call, which created a lot of tension. And someone wrote a story which they said they couldn't prove and wasn't well verified. I think it was published in like the opinion section of News 24 or something, saying that apparently what had happened was Zuma had planned to create, engineer riots, particularly in KZN, and then he would declare a state of emergency, pull the army out into the streets, block off Parliament to protect himself from the vote of no confidence, which was imminently about to happen at that time, and essentially try to run the country as a dictator. Now, you know, who knows if that story is true. But I must say, the recent trouble we've had sounds an awful lot like stage one of that plan. Am I completely mad to think that, Herman?
No, I don't think you're completely mad. I hate alarmism. I genuinely hate it. I don't trust conspiracy theories. I think they've all been made up. But the thing about that was a very lame conspiracy theory joke, by the way. But the thing about these sorts of things is we're in a country where they are just possible enough for us to take it seriously and, you know, apply pressure there where we can.
I see some people already actually describing the recent day's events as an attempted coup of sort. And allegedly the reason why the Zuma plot did not come to pass is that the leadership of the South African National Defence Force did not agree to go along with it. They objected. Maurice, your thoughts on this?
Look, I think what you're saying is very likely. And I mean, it just shows you that it's a very good thing that Jacob Zuma does not have any state power anymore. And I think also tells you a lot about the guy that it seems there might be Zuma sympathizers within the cabinet, but nobody that anybody takes seriously is on Zuma's side anymore. I mean, if you look at his main supporters, it is it's people like Carl Nias, it's people like Zwaneli Mani. It's very much a rogues gallery. Exactly. Yeah. Nobody in South Africa takes those people seriously, or nobody who's serious takes them seriously. So it tells you something, but I don't know,
Maurice, they get a lot of media coverage for people who aren't taking
seriously. Yeah, but also, I mean, if it leads, it bleeds, you know? I mean, if it bleeds, it leads, whatever. Or, you know, it's clickbait, and I mean, you can't blame the media. I mean, you'll go put Carl Nias's latest mad rantings on your front page because people want to see what the guy was saying, you know? But yeah, but I think we were probably the closest to becoming dictatorship post-apartheid South Africa when Jacob Zuma was at the end of his term. And I think we're lucky that there were cool heads and the SANDF did the right thing. I mean, if he'd had loyalists in the SANDF who said, well, yeah, we'll support you, who knows what could have happened from there. But luckily, the SANDF did the job it's supposed to do and reported to, you know, supported its loyalties to the South African state and the constitution, not any individual. Unless that individual happens to be the president at the time, obviously.
Maybe it was just their loyalty to the Ramaphosa faction. We have yet to see the ANC being challenged in the same kind of way.
Nick, sorry to go on about this, but I think this is one of the key differences between us and Zimbabwe. And I think there are a lot of similarities, but there are two key differences in my mind. Number one, our liberation leader voluntarily stepped down through constitutional means. Mugabe never did. I think that established a very good constitutional precedent and it ingrained factionalism within the ruling party. Very good. The second thing is the personality leadership potency of Mugabe over the Zimbabwean military forces was immense. So he could do your Gukurandi style yes. abuse of the populace. We don't have that here, and we should be very thankful.
Yeah, no, I agree with that completely. All right, let us move on. Of course, we will talk about whatever developments come up over the next couple of days. But let's move overseas to that great friend and ally of the ANC, and that is, of course, Cuba, who have been in a bit of a spot of bother over the past couple of days, with people walking through the streets in the largest protests I think that Cuba has ever seen. And it happens to be a country where non-state sanctioned demonstrations are not legal for the most part. People have been chanting freedom, down with the government, give us political freedom, give us democracy. Some carried American flags in a particular move to know that they could be able to taunt the Cuban government with that, although I think that's quite divisive amongst the protesters there. And the Cuban government has tried to respond with force, as they usually do this sort of thing in most cases. A couple of people have died, at least one person has died, and more than 100 have been arrested. The government has accused the protesters of being foreign-backed plotters and minions of the United States.
Capitalist running dogs.
Capitalist running dogs. But they had to make some concessions to some of the demands of the protesters over the last few days. One of those concessions is that, and get this, despite the fact that Cuba blames all of its economic problems on an American blockade, it charges steep tariffs on any travelers bringing in food or medical supplies or anything into the country. And one of the demands of the protests was that this be scrapped, and the Cuban government has now agreed to do that. So this is presumably because protesters and people want to bring in food and medicine that's not available in Cuba into the country without having to pay some exorbitant tax or possibly be arrested for smuggling. Herman, are we finally going to see the end of communist Cuba, do you think, anytime soon?
I don't. I don't think that this is... let me put it this way. If this had happened 4 years ago, I think there would have been a better shot. If there was a Republican president, if there was a Republican House of Representatives, or even a Republican Senate, two of the three branches of American state in Republican hands, I think you would have seen, number one, a shift in foreign policy, or an aggressive shift in foreign policy from Foggy Bottom, the State Department, to hasten to add fuel to this flame of liberty. But I think we are looking at a situation where there isn't enough international will politically to back these protesters, to strengthen their hand, to force real, fundamental, long-term, lasting change in Cuba, which is terribly sad. But I think that's a painful reality, and something that perhaps on a different level the Hong Kong protest showed us.
Exactly. Maurice, your thoughts on this issue? It's not a good week for the ANC when their best friends mm-hmm. overseas also seem to be having their own trouble.
No, but I saw a couple of wags on Twitter who there are photos of these Cuban police attacking demonstrators, and they said maybe we should get Cuban police rather than Cuban doctors to South Africa to come sort out the problems in this country, because that's a terrible idea. But there's also the internet was shut down, and it's a lot easier actually in Cuba because the internet company there is owned by the government. And I believe mobile internet only came to Cuba, internet you can access from your cell phone, only came to Cuba at the end of 2018, I think. So it's a very new thing, and a lot of the protests were being driven by people speaking on WhatsApp and Facebook and all that kind of thing. And apparently the main protest started through, it was a spontaneous thing, and it was somebody in Havana who was doing a live broadcast on Facebook, and then people just started coming out apparently in their numbers and what have you. But I saw a very interesting article on Reuters, and it tells you a lot about how different things are perceived. So it's from the Pan American Health Organization, which I assume is basically the America's version of the WHO. And it says Protests in Cuba will increase the risk of COVID-19 transmission because of an already high level of cases and the more contagious Delta variant. This was according to the Pan American Health Organization, which urged Cubans to avoid crowds, wear masks, and frequently wash hands. Now, that may all be true, but remember during the Black Lives Matter protest last year, lots of medical professionals said, you know what, racism is a much bigger problem than COVID-19. Racism is the real medical emergency. Therefore, it doesn't matter, go protest. And, I mean, that's all fine, but you can't. COVID doesn't ask the people what they're protesting about. Oh, you're protesting against the communist regime in Havana. Oh, I'm going to infect you. Oh, no, okay, you're protesting for Black Lives Matter. Cool, you say. You know, either protests are spread COVID or they don't. I mean,
this... Yeah, don't you know the virus is woke, Marius?
Yeah, exactly. So, but I mean, this kind of gaslighting, it's something that's is actually also quite concerning, and I'm definitely not a fan of it. I'm sure neither of you are either.
Yes. Herman, any final thoughts on this?
Well, I think it goes back to a thing that we actually looked at a few weeks ago, is the politicization of things that used to be a public service, nonpartisan sort of position. And that's a great loss. I think it's probably one of the most significant changes of a 300-year period of history now coming to an end.
Mm. Well, one last point I'd like to make is just you mentioned those American flags. It's quite interesting to me, too. There have been lots of protests around the world in recent times, and the American flag is often held up as kind of a symbol of freedom. We saw it in Hong Kong. I think that I've seen them in Venezuelan protests. I think they've also been in Myanmar. So despite, I mean, there's obviously a lot to criticize in the U.S., but a lot of people still look to it as a symbol of freedom, and I think to a large degree it still is, I mean, for all its problems. I think we can all agree that we'd rather that the U.S. won the Cold War, and when World War III starts between the U.S. and China, I think it'll probably be better for the world if the U.S. wins that.
Well, I think that goes without question. I don't think any of us wants to live in a world dominated by the People's Republic of China, with their 1984-esque totalitarian surveillance states, entrenched corruption in their vassals. And of course, never mind their racial mobilization, nationalism of Chinese people. And potentially what could be a genocide going on in Xinjiang at the moment. Mm. Yeah. So I know which side I'm on if it comes to that. But hopefully it doesn't come to that, because nuclear armed powers going to war with each other is never fun.
Oh, it's something we need to talk about in the Daily Venture soon, is that I saw something on Twitter, and they reckon within 10 years, the Red Army is about, People's Liberation Army is about, has a 66% chance of beating the US in a shooting war. Right now, military experts think it's about 50-50. So I think that's definitely something to talk about in a future edition.
Yeah, although, it depends on so much. That is very much a discussion for another time, and hopefully one that will remain very theoretical, the last Cold War ended probably the best way that a Cold War can end. Mm. Let's hope that the second one ends in the same way, perhaps with maybe a little bit less poverty in China, but anyway. Okay, so let us call it to a close there. This is, of course, the last show for the week. I see one of the people watching says that they like the live version. I'm glad that you do. It is a little bit experimental, but I think we're having fun nonetheless. We'll see you next week on Monday, probably around 1:30. I think it is Marius and Herman again, assuming there are no meetings to interrupt things. have a wonderful weekend, everyone. We'll see you, and keep the flag of liberty flying, everyone.